This is the September 2020 Criminal Law Update, CLE, based on decisions released by our New York State appellate courts dealing with criminal law in the month of September 2020. Decisions were chosen for summarization. The summaries were put up on the New York Appellate Digest website in September, and they've since been collected into the September 2020 Criminal Law Update pamphlet. And the page references here in the audio are to the pages of that pamphlet. First case is on page 4, People versus Eduardo S. It deals with the invalidity of the defendant's waiver of appeal under these facts. The second department held the waiver of appeal was invalid because it was first mentioned after the guilty plea and after the sentence promise. And the explanation of the purportedly waived appellate rights was deemed insufficient. The court wrote, "The appeal waiver was not mentioned by the Supreme Court prior to the defendant's plea of guilty, but only afterward. Accordingly, the defendant received no material benefit from his appeal waiver, as the court had already accepted the defendant's plea and made its sentence promise. Under such circumstances, and in the absence of a request by the people, the court's insistence upon the execution of an appeal waiver was a gratuitous, after-the-fact additional demand asserted after the bargain had already been struck. In addition, the court's colloquy on this issue, conducted after the plea had already been accepted, mischaracterized the appellate rights waived as encompassing an absolute bar to the taking of a direct appeal. Contrary to the people's contention, those defects were not cured by the terms of the standard written appeal waiver form, which not only lacked detail and repeated many of the mischaracterizations contained in the court's colloquy, but further misstated that the defendant was giving up the right to all post-conviction relief separate from the direct appeal." So the takeaway here, the failure to mention the waiver of appeal until after the guilty plea and after the sentence promise, combined with the insufficient description of the rights waived, rendered the waiver unenforceable. Because the defendant had already pled guilty, he received no benefit from the waiver. Next is People versus Upson on pages 4 and 5. It deals with the admission of social media accounts, the content of social media accounts. The second department held it was harmless error to admit in evidence the content of social media accounts which was not authenticated. The court wrote, "We disagree with the Supreme Court's determination admitting into evidence certain content from various social media accounts. The people failed to present sufficient evidence that the subject social media accounts belonged to the defendant, that the photographs on the accounts were accurate and authentic, or that the statements found on one of the accounts were made by the defendant." So the takeaway, to be admissible, evidence drawn from social media accounts, including statements and photographs, must be connected to the defendant. Next is People versus Branch, pages 5 and 6. It's a constructive possession case. The second department, reversing the possession of a weapon convictions, held the evidence of constructive possession was insufficient and the convictions were therefore against the weight of the evidence. The court wrote, "The evidence demonstrated that the defendant resided in the third bedroom of the searched premises and that the defendant's brother had resided in the first bedroom up until his death in 2014 or 2015. There was also testimony that after the defendant's brother passed away, the door to the first bedroom was locked and remained locked. There was no evidence that the defendant frequented the first bedroom, had a key to that room, or kept his belongings in that room. Although the police witnesses testified that they could not recall any damage to the door to the first bedroom, the defense introduced a photograph depicting damage to the door and frame after the search. although the police officers recovered a magazine containing 7 9-millimeter cartridges from the defendant's bedroom, the evidence demonstrated that it was not the correct magazine for the pistol recovered from the first bedroom. It had to be manipulated in order to function properly with the pistol. Apart from the magazine, there was no other evidence connecting the defendant to the first bedroom or the weapons found in the first bedroom. So the takeaway, weapons seized from a locked bedroom, which belonged to defendant's deceased brother, should not have been admitted in evidence. The proof requirements for constructive possession were not met. There was no evidence defendant exercised dominion and control over the bedroom or its contents. Next is People v. Zayas on page 6. It's a disclosure case based on the law, the criminal procedure law 245.70 that went into effect in January of 2020. Second Department, reversing county court, held some restrictions on making discovery available to the defense should have been imposed. The court wrote, applying the factors set forth in criminal procedure law 245.70 subdivision 4, including the concerns for witness safety and protection, the county court should have directed disclosure of the audio and video recordings of the narcotics sales be made available forthwith to defense counsel only, to be viewed at the prosecutor's office. The county court should have delayed disclosure of the names, addresses, and contact information of the confidential informant and undercover personnel until the commencement of trial. So the takeaway here, again, under the newly enacted criminal procedure law, section 245.70, parties can seek quick appellate review of discovery decisions made by the motion court. These decisions usually involve whether access to evidence prior to hearings or trial should be restricted to protect the safety of witnesses or undercover law enforcement personnel. Next is People v. Brown on pages 7 and 8. It's a motion to vacate the conviction on ineffective assistance grounds. The defendant had been offered 4.5 to 9 years if he pled guilty. He rejected it. And apparently he was not told that he may be subject to a persistent felony offender sentence of life imprisonment after trial. So he made a motion to vacate, alleging that his attorney was ineffective for failing to inform him of the possibility of being sentenced as a persistent felony offender. And the motion court found the motion to be meritorious, but in effect, the motion court simply left the convictions in place and eventually just reinstated the original sentence. The court wrote, the plain language of Criminal Procedure Law 44010 Subdivision 4 requires that upon a finding that a defendant's CPL 440 motion is meritorious, a court must vacate the judgment, and upon doing so, must then select one of three options: dismiss the accusatory instrument, order a new trial, or take such other action as is appropriate in the circumstances. And here, apparently, the motion court simply left the convictions in place and did not vacate the conviction, in spite of finding the ineffective assistance argument meritorious. So there are two aspects to this, two takeaways from this decision. One is defense counsel's failure to inform the defendant that if he goes to trial, he may be sentenced as a persistent felony offender to life in prison in the face of a plea offer for 4.5 to 9 years constitutes ineffective assistance. And the other takeaway from the case is that once a court agrees with a defendant's argument in a 440 motion and finds it meritorious, the statute gives the court only three options. And under the facts here, it's really only two options: to dismiss the accusatory instrument or order a new trial. And the court did not have the power to do what it did here, simply leaving the convictions in place after agreeing with the ineffective assistance argument, and then eventually reinstating the original sentence. Next is People v. Muniz Cayetano on page 8. It's a guilty plea case. First Department, vacating defendant's guilty plea for attempted burglary, held that Supreme Court should have ensured that the defendant understood he was waiving the intoxication defense by pleading guilty. During the plea colloquy, defendant indicated he was drunk and didn't know what he was doing when he entered a woman's hotel room. The court wrote, once defendant raised the possible defense of intoxication during the allocution, the court was obligated to determine if he understood the defense, whether he in fact had a viable defense, and whether he wanted to waive the same. Defendant's statement that he entered the victim's hotel room looking for money from the lady did not effectively recant his earlier statement as to intoxication and did not relieve the court of its duty to engage in an additional inquiry into defendant's understanding of the intoxication defense. So the takeaway on this one, once the defendant in his plea allocution said that he was drunk and he didn't know what he was doing at the time of the commission of the crime, the court should have made sure he understood the availability of the intoxication defense before accepting his guilty plea. Next is People v. O'Brien on page 9. It deals with multiplicity and inclusory concurrent counts. Second Department held that three counts of a vehicular homicide indictment were multiplicitous, and the DWI and DWAI counts were inclusory concurrent counts of the vehicular homicide second degree. The court wrote, while the people contend that each count of vehicular manslaughter required them to prove additional facts that the others did not, in fact, the people were only required to prove that the defendant violated one subdivision of Vehicle and Traffic Law Section 1192 in order to prove his guilt under Penal Law Section 125.12, Subdivision 1. The people's election to proceed on a theory that the defendant had violated more than one such subdivision by presenting evidence of his multiple distinct manners of intoxication was not necessary to establish his guilt. Thus, a conviction on one count of vehicular manslaughter in the second degree would have been inconsistent with an acquittal on any other count charging the same offense predicated upon a different manner of intoxication. Accordingly, we agree with the defendant that counts 5, 6, and 7 of the indictment were multiplicitous of count 4. Although the dismissal of the multiplicitous counts will not affect the duration of defendant's sentence of imprisonment, it is nevertheless appropriate to dismiss these counts in consideration of the stigma attached to the redundant convictions. The defendant's convictions of driving while intoxicated in violation of subdivisions 2 and 3 of Vehicle and Traffic Law Section 1192 and driving while ability impaired under subdivisions 4 and 4A of Vehicle and Traffic Law Section 1192 are inclusory concurrent counts of vehicular manslaughter in the second degree. Accordingly, those convictions must also be reversed. So the takeaways here, vehicular manslaughter counts were multiplicitous even though they were based on different subdivisions of Vehicle and Traffic Law Section 1192, and the convictions on the counts alleging violations of Vehicle and Traffic Law 1192 were inclusory concurrent counts of vehicular manslaughter and were reversed. Next is People v. McKinnon on pages 10 and 11. It deals with jury instructions and the important point that if the jury instructions are not objected to by the people. The people are held to the proof required by that jury instruction. The second department, reversing the burglary conviction as against the weight of the evidence, determined the people were held to the proof required by the jury instructions to which the people did not object. The portion of the instructions which explained that entry into a private area of a building after entering the building through a public area constitutes unlawful entry was left out. Because the defendant entered the building through a public entrance, the people did not prove unlawful entry as charged to the jury. The second department also held that defense counsel's failure to make a speedy trial motion did not constitute ineffective assistance because it was not clear the motion would succeed. The court wrote, while the failure to make a meritorious speedy trial motion can constitute ineffective assistance of counsel, the speedy trial violation must have been clear-cut and dispositive. In other words, the motion must not only be meritorious, it generally must not require resolution of novel issues or resolution of whether debatable exclusions of time are applicable. Here, the issue cannot be fairly characterized as clear-cut and dispositive so as to render defense counsel ineffective for failing to make such a motion. The testimony at trial was unequivocal that the defendant and two cohorts entered the subject premises, a self-storage facility, during business hours, using the entrance designated for use by the public. The defendant's entry into the premises was therefore lawful. While the defendant's subsequent act of entering a non-public area of the premises could constitute an unlawful entry, in light of the Supreme Court's charge omitting that portion of the instruction, elaborating upon license and privilege as it applies to non-public areas within public places, and asking the jury whether the defendant unlawfully entered the premises generally, it was factually insufficient to prove that the defendant's entry was unlawful. So the takeaway, if the people do not object to a jury instruction, the appellate court will review the evidence in the light of that jury instruction as it was given. And here the jury instruction left out the part which explained that entry of a private part of a building after using a public entrance is an unlawful entry. The defendant here used a public entrance, so the unlawful entry element as described in the jury instructions was not proven. Next is People v. John Vier, J-A-N-V-I-E-R. It deals with a sentencing issue as it relates to immigration consequences. The Second Department, over a two-justice dissent, held defendant's one-year sentence for assault, which had already been served at the time of the appeal, should not be reduced by one day to avoid the immigration consequences of the one-year sentence, which was deportation. The court wrote, we have rejected requests for one-day sentence reductions in cases with immigration consequences where the defendants used physical force or violence in the commission of their crimes against others. Here, the defendant's conduct involved violence against two assault victims, so that a one-day sentence reduction would be an outlier measured against our existing precedents. Next is People v. Dice. On page 13, it's another sentencing case. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant should not have been sentenced as a second felony offender because the federal conviction did not qualify as the equivalent of a New York felony. The court wrote, the defendant was improperly adjudicated a second felony offender on the basis of a prior federal conviction for possession of a firearm with an obliterated serial number. And that's 18 U.S.C. section 922, subdivision K. An out-of-state felony conviction qualifies as a predicate felony under Penal Law section 70.06 only if it is for a crime whose elements are equivalent to those of a felony in New York. Here, the defendant's predicate crime does not require as one of its elements that the firearm be operable. And it cites 18 U.S.C. section 922 subdivision K. and thus does not constitute a felony in New York for the purpose of enhanced sentencing. So the takeaway, an out-of-state felony which does not include an element in the corresponding New York felony cannot serve as a predicate felony for sentencing in New York. Here, the federal statute prohibiting possession of a firearm with an obliterated serial number does not require that the firearm be operable, but the corresponding New York felony does. Next case is People v. Goodman on pages 13 and 14, another sentencing case, this time involving whether the sentence should be consecutive or concurrent. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the evidence did not support consecutive sentences for assault second and criminal possession of a weapon second. The court wrote, the sentence imposed on the conviction of assault in the second degree should not run consecutively to the sentence imposed on the conviction of attempted criminal possession of a weapon in the second degree. There were no facts adduced at the defendant's plea allocution to establish that the defendant attempted to possess a loaded firearm before forming the intent to cause a crime with that weapon. Next is People v. Odiari. It's on page 14. It's a Sex Offender Registration Act case. Second Department, in a full-fledged opinion by Justice Maltese, held the automatic override justifying a level 3 risk level was properly based upon a psychological abnormality not specifically mentioned in the risk assessment guidelines, but it was included in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. The court wrote, in the guidelines, the board explained that it chose to require a clinical assessment of an abnormality so that loose language in a pre-sentence report would not become the basis for an override. Examples of a clinical assessment that would support an override are pedophilia and sexual sadism. The guidelines do not contain any language limiting the application of the fourth override to these two examples. And there is no requirement that a psychological abnormality must be inherently sex-related in order for the fourth override to apply. The people submitted, among other things, a psychologist's report in which the psychologist concluded, based on a clinical assessment, that the defendant suffered from schizoaffective disorder, that he experienced periods of agitation and disorganized behavior, and presents as hypersexual with low impulse control when decompensated. The psychologist further concluded that the nature of the defendant's illness placed him at an elevated risk of violence, which would likely take the form of inappropriate sexual conduct. This evidence established that there has been a clinical assessment that the defendant has a psychological, physical, or organic abnormality that decreases his ability to control impulsive sexual behavior. So the takeaway, a psychological disorder not specifically mentioned in the SORA guidelines, but included in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, can serve as the basis for an automatic override justifying a level 3 risk assessment. The disorder need not be inherently sex-related. Here, the schizoaffective disorder could manifest as inappropriate sexual conduct. Next is People v. Hinshaw, Court of Appeals case on page 15. The Court of Appeals invalidated a traffic stop that the Appellate Division had found valid. The Court of Appeals, in a full-fledged opinion by Judge Wilson, over a concurring opinion and an extensive dissenting opinion, reversing the Appellate Division, held the state trooper did not have probable cause or reasonable suspicion to support the traffic stop. The weapon and drugs found in a search of defendants, that's Mr. Henshaw's car, should have been suppressed. The stop was based entirely on an indication the car had been impounded, revealed when the officer ran the plates. The notice explicitly stated that it should not be treated as a stolen vehicle hit. The court wrote, the trooper here did not observe any violations of the vehicle and traffic law, and everything looked good. Putting aside the result of the license plate inquiry, the trooper candidly testified that he had no reason to stop the defendant. The result of the license plate check provided neither probable cause to conclude a traffic infraction had occurred, nor any basis for an objectively reasonable belief that criminal behavior had occurred or was afoot. Although the people and our dissenting colleague argue that the trooper understood the generic impound notification to require further investigation as to its cause, the trooper's speculation that the car could have been impounded for registration problems, the plates could have been suspended, insurance could have been suspended, or the vehicle could have been stolen was just that, pure speculation. Because there was not even a suggestion that the conduct of the defendant or his companions had been furtive in character before the police interfered with their car's progress, and the record here is bare of any objective evidence of criminal activity as of the time of the stop of Mr. Henshaw's vehicle was invalid. So the takeaway here, an indication that a car had been impounded without more did not justify a traffic stop. When the trooper ran the license plate, the notification the car had been impounded was accompanied by the explicit statement that the vehicle had not been stolen. Next is People v. Rodriguez. On page 16, it's a post-judgment motion to vacate the conviction. Second Department held defendant's motion to vacate his 1999 murder conviction based upon the prosecution's failure to turn over Brady material regarding a prosecution witness named Court was properly granted. The duty of disclosing exculpatory material extends to disclosure of evidence impeaching the credibility of a prosecution witness whose testimony may be determinative of guilt or innocence. The defendant was not provided with material regarding Court's participation as a witness in two unrelated homicide trials, along with prior agreements between Court and law enforcement, including her use as a confidential informant by police and her placement in a witness relocation program following her participation in one of the unrelated homicide trials, during which her rent was paid by the office of the Kings County District Attorney for approximately 1 year. This material contradicted Court's trial testimony that she did not have any deals with law enforcement and had not been in touch with the district attorney's office for a long period of time, as well as the prosecutor's arguments during summation that Court never took a deal and never asked for anything in return. Court's involvement with law enforcement was both favorable and material to the defense, and the people's failure to disclose this information to the defense violated defendant's constitutional right to due process. In addition, the errors were compounded by the prosecution's repetition and emphasis on the misinformation during summation. So the takeaway for this case, the failure to inform the defendant of a witness's significant involvement with law enforcement and other homicide trials justified the vacation of this 1999 murder conviction. Next is People v. Krivak. K-R-I-V-A-K, page 17, it's another motion to vacate a conviction, this time a 1996 murder conviction. Second Department held county court properly granted defendant's motion to vacate his conviction stemming from a 1996 murder, despite defendant's confession, based upon evidence of third-party culpability, that is, statements allegedly made by a man named Gombert or Gombert to Santoro about Gombert's involvement in the crime. The court wrote, "We find that the newly discovered evidence is of such character as to create a probability that had such evidence been received at the trial, the verdict would have been more favorable to the defendant," citing Criminal Procedure Law 44010, Subdivision 1G. A reasonable jury could credit Santoro's testimony regarding the statements made by Gombert, including that he could not be charged with the rape and murder of the victim because they already got the other suckers, and find that such statements raise a reasonable doubt as to the defendant's involvement in the subject crimes. Had Santoro's testimony been available to the defendant at trial, defense counsel could have advanced the theory that Gombert was the actual perpetrator of the crimes, rather than merely denying the defendant's involvement. In fact, the co-defendant was acquitted following his third trial, at which Santoro's testimony was admitted for the first time. Although the evidence presented at the defendant's trial included the defendant's statement confessing to the crimes, the record reveals the existence of circumstances casting doubt on that statement. The portion of the defendant's statement regarding how he tied the victim's hands together was inconsistent with the testimony of a medical examiner for the people as to the manner in which the victim was hog-tied with rope. In addition, the defendant presented testimony at trial from a polygraph examiner who opined that the defendant was telling the truth during a polygraph examination when he initially denied raping and killing the victim. So the takeaway: newly discovered evidence that a third party had made statements admitting to the commission of the offense, combined with circumstances casting doubt on the defendant's confession, justified vacating the defendant's 1996 murder conviction. At this point, I'm going to insert the verification code to be placed on your attorney affirmation for the September 2020 Criminal Law Update CLE. The verification code is VACATE. Again, the verification code to be placed on your attorney affirmation for this September 2020 Criminal Law Update CLE is VACATE. Next is the final case in this CLE on page 18. It deals with the judge's decide to preclude the defendant from presenting some witnesses. The Second Department, reversing defendant's scheme to defraud conviction, held defendant should not have been precluded from calling witnesses in good faith. The court wrote, pursuant to Penal Law Section 155.15, Subdivision 1, in any prosecution for larceny committed by embezzlement, it is an affirmative defense that the property was appropriated under a claim of right made in good faith. In this case, the defendant claimed that the money from the grant from the Office of Children and Family Service was appropriated mistakenly, but in good faith, as reimbursement for expenses he personally paid for events occurring in 2008 and 2009, after the grant was awarded, but in a time period not covered by the grant. The defendant intended to call as witnesses a videographer who would attest to the fact that he got paid for services at a 2009 event, and others who would testify as to other expenses at that event. The record does not establish that the defendant was acting in bad faith in seeking to present the testimony of these witnesses at the trial. The proposed testimony did not deal with a collateral issue, but rather went to the heart of the defendant's claim of right defense. Thus, it was error for the Supreme Court to have prospectively precluded the defendant's witnesses from testifying, and under the facts of this case, that error cannot be deemed harmless. So the takeaway here, the defendant's request to present witnesses to support an affirmative defense was not made in bad faith and did not involve collateral issues. Therefore, the denial of the request required reversal of the conviction. And that concludes this September 2020 Criminal Law Update CLE.